Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did politics shape the life of Leonard Bernstein? Accused of practicing radical chic by writer Tom Wolfe, Bernstein's involvement in left-leaning causes actually reflected a lifelong and deeply held passion for politics that both drove and distracted him from his work as a composer and conductor. My guest today has just completed a unique study of Bernstein's intellectual life through the lens of hundreds of pages of FBI files withheld from the public until after his death in 1990. Barry Seldes is professor of political science at Rider University. His new book is called Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician. Barry, welcome to Think.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Can you talk about what played into the development of Leonard Bernstein's political worldview?
Right. Well, he was he entered Harvard in 1935. At the time, of course, that the Nazis were rising up in power across Europe, one, and two, a good deal of anti-Semitism at home. He was born into a Jewish home and almost automatically would have made him very, very politically aware. When he entered Harvard, he quickly gained the attention of, among others, Aaron Copland and Dimitri Mitropoulos. Copland was very much on the left, and Bernstein was, very quickly enough, in Copeland's circles in New York, so that he was immediately, therefore, plunged into a political milieu.
So he was always overtly active in politics as an adult?
By 1939, he certainly was. He, his last year at Harvard, led a concert of Mark Blitzstein's radical left-wing folk opera, The Cradle Will Rock, which gained the attention of the Boston police and the FBI. And from then on, until certainly into the 70s, the FBI was keeping accounts of him.
And he had really a meteoric rise in his career throughout the 1940s. Will you talk a little bit about that for us?
Right. It was quite extraordinary. As I said, he gained the attention very quickly. He was a sophomore at Harvard when he met Mitropoulos, Dimitri Mitropoulos, the great conductor, whose protege he became. Very shortly thereafter, Aaron Copland, in the most extraordinary meeting, which I'll talk about in a moment if you wish, and then shortly after that, the conductor of the Boston Symphony, Serge Koussevitzky. So by the time he was only a sophomore in college, he already was well known to three giants in the American musical world.
We'll talk about his relationship to Copland.
Well, what happened then was that he had learned of the piano sonata of Copland, which was an anthem for young modernists, and memorized the piece. By sheer fortuity, he had gone to a concert of the Boston Symphony, and guess who he was sitting next to? But Copland himself. And the two got into a conversation. Copland invited him to New York. When Bernstein walked into his apartment, which was loaded with luminaries, Virgil Thompson, Paul Bowles, Copland himself, Bernstein bragged that he could play the sonata, the piano sonata, by heart. They said, impossible. Bernstein sat at the piano and did just that, and that was, for them, immediate recognition of this young man's genius.
And his first major conducting debut happened almost accidentally.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary story in itself. He, having left Harvard, went off to Curtis Institute in Philadelphia, majoring in piano, but under Metropolis's direction, he quickly switched, majored to conducting. Fritz Reiner was his teacher. He left Curtis, and within a year, they obtained for him the assistantship of the New York Philharmonic, his new assistant conductor. It was in, I think, November 1943 that Radzinski, who was the conductor, was out of town. Bruno Walter was supposed to conduct and took ill, and Bernstein was asked to quickly get to Carnegie Hall to conduct. Unheard of for an assistant conductor. He quickly showed up and conducted the works on that were required of him. That broadcast happened. That happened to be a broadcast. The CBS was broadcasting the Philharmonic in those days. And the next morning, the New York Times carried the story of this extraordinary young man who had conducted so brilliantly, and from then on, his career was in the ascendant.
So he was sort of, it felt like an overnight sensation to people who just became aware of him at that point.
Right.
Was the New York Times piece, did anything reveal the fact that he was so involved in politics and this was such a major part of his life and his outlook on the world?
Well, what happened was that almost immediately upon the that great moment at the Philharmonic, and then shortly thereafter, his own first symphony being performed, he became very well known to left-wing groups. He was a left-winger himself, and began to appear at all kinds of functions on behalf of the war effort, on behalf of refugees, and on behalf of civil rights campaigns. So he was all through the early 40s, 44, 45, in fact, 43, 44, 45, appearing regularly in left-wing causes. The FBI, again, was beginning to note all of these.
Yeah, this was starting to be a very dangerous time to be involved in left-wing causes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you talk about when the communist sort of witch hunters specifically first took notice of him?
I think the first, first of all, the FBI had begun to collect information on Bernstein almost by about 1941. And the first entry has got to do with reporting a Boston police report that claimed that Bernstein was part of a cell at Harvard. Remember, he graduated from Harvard in 39. So the FBI is already looking into events about Bernstein starting in 1939 with claims, again, of his membership in the Communist Party. Something that was never proved, but something that J. Edgar Hoover sought to prove for decades. In any event, the FBI was collecting all of this data on him. The first time that Bernstein was really aware of anything happening to him was in 1946. What happened there was that he had been appearing on behalf of the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee. That was an organization set up to aid refugees coming out of Europe, especially coming out of Franco Spain. By 1946, 47, the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee was becoming known to the U.S. government as a communist front. In fact, anyone supporting Franco Spain in those days was automatically suspected by the FBI and the Attorney General of being a communist front. Sure enough, Bernstein began to feel pressure when he was told by his agency not to show up at a meeting of the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee that was to be held in San Francisco. He was supposed to deliver a speech, and he was told not to appear. He was furious. He did appear, did not deliver the speech, but told his secretary that there was no question that he was under some kind of repressive action by the authorities.
Was he frightened by that attention or, as you mentioned, simply angry?
He was angry, but he didn't give the speech. In other words, he had to somehow mollify his agency. He could have been destroyed had he gone forward. But he was, on the other hand, going to show up, and so he did.
Let's go forward in time here a little bit and talk about your knowledge. When did you find out that the FBI files on him had existed and then that they had been released?
Okay, I think the year was 1995, and I was hunting for a big project to do. I just finished some smaller ones and opened my New York Times to read that the FBI files had been given over under the Freedom of Information Act to the Southern California American Civil Liberties Union. Well, that was great for me because I was so interested. Bernstein won. I was a follower of Gustav Mahler's music, and Bernstein, of course, was Mahler's champion.
Yeah.
And I had done some work with FBI stuff in the past, so I wrote to the Southern California ACLU, and very shortly thereafter, I paid them something like $35 for Xeroxing the hundreds and hundreds of pages. They sent me this vast collection of material. I was, I suppose, the very first to read all of it. So that's how I got to it.
And did you think that you knew before you received them what you might find?
There's a yes and there's a no here. The yes part is that Bernstein's left-wing politics was well known for decades, but the degree to which he had been active, with whom he had been active, how he had been active, this was pretty much unknown. Some of it had been revealed here or there, but really nothing comprehensive. By opening these files and suddenly seeing before me newspaper clippings that the FBI had amassed, data on what Bernstein had been doing, people to whom he had been talking, memos inside the Truman and Eisenhower administration to the FBI and amongst officials in those administrations, these were eye-openers.
He was on a list that said that if there were some kind of national crisis, I suppose a nuclear strike or something during the Cold War, that he would be detained along with other people who were on the left.
That's right. Under the McCarran Act of 1949, I think it was, U.S. government set up, among others, the possibility of concentration camps within which would be detained citizens who were suspect of somehow or other about to help an invader. Security list was made up. Bernstein was on it. And he would have been sent to the prison or to the concentration camp in Ellenwood, Pennsylvania, more than likely. But what happened was that the Supreme Court knocked down that provision, among others, that never came to pass. But Hoover was all set to have him detained. We would have had permanent detention way before Guantanamo had that act been allowed to proceed.
Why do you think J. Edgar Hoover was so specifically convinced that Bernstein posed a threat?
That's a very good question. In the sense that Hoover had thought that Bernstein was a member of the Communist Party and went after him, could never find it. And here's where Hoover really was hoping to sink his teeth into Bernstein. In 1950, if I may jump ahead, in 1953, Bernstein had was blacklisted from, among others, Hollywood and had lost his passport. His passport was revoked by the State Department. In order to get his passport back, which he had to do to maintain his career, he employed a lawyer who had been part of the crusade against communists and progressives, which turned out to be very, very good for Bernstein because the attorney was able to get Bernstein's passport back, provided Bernstein signed an affidavit of non-communist membership. I can get back into that affidavit a bit later, but let me just say this. Once he signed that affidavit, he was vulnerable to charges of perjury should it be found out that he was a member of the Communist Party. So Hoover sought to pursue a charge of perjury for years and could never find it, but was out to get Bernstein on this charge. Why the particular animus against Bernstein? I think because Bernstein's membership or the fact of it eluded Hoover, and I guess in Hoover's personality was the necessity to go after those people who he thought were lying to him.
And he wanted to make an example of Bernstein.
He certainly would have, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Let's talk about the affidavit, because it's interesting the sort of thing that you had to say in the early 50s to sort of prove to good, upstanding Americans that you were, in fact, not someone who was a sympathizer with the Communist Party.
Right. In Naming Names by Victor Navasky, we get the real lowdown on this. So here's what Navasky pretty much discovered and Bernstein had to pursue. You had to testify that you were a good, solid American. You had to testify that against all your previous sins, I put that between quotation marks, your political sins, you had to testify that you were a religious person, that you were going to go to synagogue, church, temple, mosque, whatever it might be. Bernstein had to also testify that he was only going to vote or only had voted Republican or Democrat. He had to testify that he was duped into whatever he had believed in or whatever he had done. All of this to mollify the authorities. But that was the rite of passage that one had to undertake in order to get back into the good graces of orthodoxy.
And you were forced to make this sort of tacit admission of guilt.
That's right. That's right. It wasn't so tacit. You had to sign this document. In Bernstein's case, he was very lucky because the deal made with his attorney was that the affidavit would be kept quiet. It would only be circulated amongst the vigilante groups that were going to give you a free pass now to get off the blacklist. That's what happened. But it was kept secret all these decades, and only until I've talked about it in my book, so far as I know, has it been made public.
Barry Seldes is my guest. He's a professor of political science at Rider University. His new book is called Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
is Leonard Bernstein conducting his Symphony No. 1. I'm not sure of the date of the recording, but the piece was written in 1942. My guest this hour is Barry Seldes, professor of political science at Rider University. His new book is called Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician. Join our conversation this afternoon by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Barry, do you hear politics in even the orchestral works of Leonard Bernstein?
Sure. The verse that we were just playing, the Jeremiah Symphony, has a lot of reminiscences of Russian music. It was written at a time when the U.S. and the Soviet Union were fighting against the Nazis. So Bernstein wrote that certainly as a kind of peace in honor of our then-Soviet allies. And, of course, from then on, Bernstein was almost inevitably inspired by social and political events in virtually all his compositions. His texts were chosen, oftentimes, with a political view in mind. So one of the points I make in the book is that if one follows Bernstein's life as a politically aware man, which he was, and there's a good deal of evidence about that, one can then see how the music, especially the texts he chose for the music, were inspired by those events. I'm not a musicologist, so I'm not going to testify about the innards of the music itself. But in terms of the texts he chose, and then the music he wrote against those texts, one can understand, yes, indeed, a very politically driven man, politically driven composer.
Do you think these vast audiences that he built for himself fully comprehended that?
No.
No. Was he all right with that?
Well, no, he wasn't all right with that. I'll explain why. Let's talk about West Side Story for a moment, which is probably his most famous piece. And he rued the fact that he said at one point, I hope I won't be remembered for West Side Story, because he wanted to write a much more explicitly political work. And that haunted him to the end of his days in 1990. He wanted to write a work that would be inspirational, that would bring that would be compelling to the American audience, that would bring them back to the ideals that he thought were lost with the end of the New Deal. And that's why Bernstein felt that a good deal of his music would be misunderstood, because he never wrote the piece he wanted to write. On the other hand, he was very proud of what he wrote, of course. But whether the audience caught it, I'm not too sure. Let's say this, with his second symphony, The Age of Anxiety, which was done after the Auden poem, which was a Pulitzer Prize-winning poem, I think the audience that knew the poem could easily feel the poem in the music. His third symphony contained a good deal of political motifs about war, about the horror of firebombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So there one could follow certainly a political intent. And somewhat of the same with his last opera, which was A Quiet Place, about being a gay young man in a family, which frowned upon that aspect of one's life. So yes and no to the answer to the question about whether Bernstein's audience would know of these political events.
Yeah, Bernstein was married for years with children and also had affairs with men. At what point did that become public knowledge?
With the men? Mm-hmm. I would think that he got very upset with David Diamond, the composer, revealing to Joan Pizer about his gay relationships. But I think it was always known, in the sense that, you know, that gets bandied about. But he certainly was out of the closet, so to speak, by the mid-70s.
Can you talk about, of course, that was one of the causes that was near and dear to his heart, but can you talk about some of the specific things that he really felt that he wanted to dedicate his energies to?
Right. By the 1960s, after when the Blacklist era was over and John Kennedy had won the presidency, a lot of left-wingers like Bernstein, who had gone into a kind of hiding in the 50s, at least political hiding, began to emerge once again. And he became very active in the civil rights movement. He became very active against the war. And one of the major motifs of his speeches in the era of the Vietnam War was opposition to the military-industrial complex, which, and he was quite outspoken, which he thought was distorting the American economy and American social policy, depriving all kinds of areas of life, poor people who were being deprived of possible benefits, employment patterns, being distorted by the military-industrial complex. He thought that this had to end, and he was very, very active in struggling against this. And of course, his, as I said earlier, his Third Symphony, Kaddish, which he wrote in 1962, reflected what would become so much part of his speeches and his work during the war.
And you mentioned his interest in civil rights. As early as 1939, he planned to put together what he called, and these are his words, an all-Negro symphony orchestra, which was almost unheard of at that time.
Right. He was going to do this in Philadelphia and wrote to his secretary, his former piano teacher, now his secretary, Helen Coates, that he was going to do this. I don't think it ever materialized, but he certainly was active this way. And later on, he signed petitions against the imprisonment of a black woman in the South who was illegally imprisoned, and a whole host and variety of other kinds of civil rights activities down right into the 70s, 80s.
Let's go back to the blacklisting, because we've already talked about the sort of federal blacklist, but he was also blacklisted by CBS.
Yes. CBS broadcast the Philharmonic concerts, and when CBS blacklisted him, the thought must have been, and I say must have because this is not documented in the strict sense, but the thought must have entered his mind that the blacklist could extend to the Philharmonic and to the American Concert Hall. And this became even more apparent when he was deprived of his passport. For those of us old enough to remember, Paul Robeson, the great singer, was deprived of his passport and his career withered. Bernstein, being deprived of his passport, could have meant, of course, he couldn't conduct abroad. If the blacklist, which had already extended to the State Department, to CBS, and to Hollywood, might now extend to the concert hall, to the podium, he would be in very deep trouble indeed. So he saw that the various venues within which he would be able to operate being closed off one after the next. And although the Philharmonic never did close to him, he took it on the lam. He simply dropped out of conducting at the Philharmonic for fear, this is my hypothesis, my hunch, for fear that the blacklist was about to happen there.
So he wanted to avoid it before it took place.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Because had it taken place, then it would have been a blackout across the country. His conducting career would have been over.
Yeah. CBS, on the other hand, turned things around a few years later, in part because the Ford Foundation was willing to stand by him.
Extraordinary, yes. There was a man named Saudek, S-A-U-D-E-K, who was with the Ford Foundation. And he was in charge of the cultural and other kinds of planning and sponsoring of shows. And he wanted to get liberals and intellectuals and artists on radio and television. And he's an unsung hero. He ought to be spoken more of. So what he did was to tell CBS, I want Bernstein on my program. Now, the first case that had come up that actually preceded Bernstein's was of someone else whose name slips my mind. But that person was, Saldek told CBS, if the sponsors pull out because of the blacklist, we have enough money in the Ford Foundation to supply you with that same amount of money. He said this to CBS, and CBS's concern was, of course, with cash. So CBS said, fine, if we're going to get the money to sponsor the show, even if this man is suspected of communist affiliation, fine, as long as we get our money. Once that had been done, Saldek was now able to get Bernstein on Omnibus. That was the show then, a wonderful TV program that was typically took place for an hour and a half, a kind of magazine of the arts. And with this, Bernstein was back on to CBS. And within a short while, this all, by the way, comes after the affidavit having been signed. With the CBS relenting, then came... already he had been able to get back into Hollywood because of the affidavits. He did the music for On the Waterfront. 1953-54 was the Omnibus show, and the next year he received his contract again with the New York Philharmonic.
Barry Seldes is my guest. He's professor of political science at Rider University. We're talking about his new book, Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician. If you'd like to be part of the conversation or ask a question, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I know, Barry, that this sort of thing will not show up directly in an FBI file, but was he angry about the blacklist or simply alarmed by it?
He was alarmed. He was in correspondence with his attorneys, but even before, let me go back to 1951, when he was living in Cuernavaca, Mexico. He had left the Philharmonic as I said, he had, as soon as the season was over, the 50-51 season, he took off. He had had plans for a sabbatical to do composing for 6 months. He suddenly extended that to 2 years. Why suddenly? He had come back in January 1 or 2, landed in New York from Europe, and on aboard ship, in the week of ship coming from France to the U.S., he had met a Hollywood producer who told him that there was no way Hollywood would employ him. He got off the boat, therefore, off the ship, obviously quite scared. He immediately then extended his sabbatical to 2 years in the New York Philharmonic to conduct, ostensibly, to compose, ostensibly, but I think also to, as I said earlier, to preempt them from blacklisting him. He went to Cuernavaca, Mexico, where he met with a number of blacklisted Hollywood writers who had been in the Hollywood 10 and who had been in jail, some of them, and they were all living down there, exiled from the U.S. And he wrote to his sister, Shirley, that he was afraid he'd be called before the House Committee on Un-American Activities, as so many of his friends had, and that he hoped he would stand up against the committee and deliver a fiery address and even risk going to jail. He hoped he had the courage to do that. So he knew that he was in trouble. When later on he was getting his, he was in the passport woes, his attorney wrote to him that you're going to be treated like every other blacklisted composer, a blacklisted artist. So he knew he was on the blacklist, and he knew that he was in trouble. So that's indeed, I think, the case. There's no question about it in my mind that he was living with alarm.
What sort of company did he have on the blacklist just among his particular contemporaries?
Aaron Copland, perhaps the most the person closest to him, but John Garfield, who died of a heart attack just as the Committee on Un-American Activities Committee had ended its hearings on him. A number of former associates, I say former, I'll tell you why in a moment, former associates at the group theater who he had known due to Copland, who had betrayed each other. Ilya Kazan had turned on his friends, as did Lee J. Cobb, as did Clifford Odets, all of them Bernstein knew well. So people all around him were testifying. Jerome Robbins, well, how could I forget him, who also turned on his friends. So around Bernstein were numbers of people, associates and former associates, who had turned on each other, who were very, very active in trying to save their own jobs, or in the case of Garfield dying as a result of a heart attack at the age of 39, with his career ruined.
So it was a time when you weren't absolutely certain who you could trust.
Yes, that's right. It's interesting about Jerome Robbins, with whom he was very close. Robbins was more or less told by the New York Daily News columnist and famed TV impresario Ed Sullivan that if Robbins didn't testify or out his colleagues, Sullivan would, and colleagues who were members of the Communist Party. And Robbins went ahead and did that. And I think fortunate for Bernstein that he never joined the Communist Party, because otherwise Robbins would have named him as well.
And Bernstein never did actually have to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. It is extraordinary that after having lived through all of this, that he maintained any kind of involvement in left-wing politics. Can you talk about his response to the Vietnam War?
Right. His anger at that war led him to make many, many speeches during great demonstrations in churches and other venues, conducting in all kinds of ways to show and to exemplify his opposition to the war. So yes, he was very, very active indeed. And in the writing of his work, Mass, there is an interesting story and with a strange twist to it. He had gone to visit Daniel Berrigan, the activist in Danbury Penitentiary. Let me just quickly enough introduce this. Daniel Berrigan and his brother Philip and a number of other Roman Catholic clerics in 1968 had invaded the, in the dark of night, had broken into the Catonsville, Maryland draft board, taken out some 600 files, and before reporters the next morning lit them on fire with napalm. They were quickly arrested and jailed after, well, Berrigan took it on the lam for a year, but the FBI found him. Bergen was in Danbury Penitentiary. Bernstein was writing Mass and went to Danbury Penitentiary, went to visit Bergen, and was going to pattern the celebrant, who's the important figure, the major protagonist in Mass, after Bergen. Bergen had written a sermon which was all about how one must stand up to repressive action, be it the Nazis in World War II, be it whoever now. Bernstein was very much taken with that, and probably was going to incorporate that into Mass, but never did. Mass turned out to be a much different kind of work. So Bernstein very, very much following what was going on with Bergen, and he and Felicia held a party to raise funds for the Bergens. They corresponded well into Bernstein's life.
And he did maintain powerful friends who were not bothered, and at the time he was writing Mass, he had a very close relationship with Jacqueline Kennedy.
Yes, in fact, he had known John Kennedy, if not at Harvard, certainly not too long afterwards. And when Kennedy was a senator in 1956, after Bernstein's resurrection from the blacklist, the Rooney Committee was about to investigate him, and he would be in trouble once again when apparently John Kennedy stepped in as a senator and got Bernstein off the hook. In 1960, when Kennedy won the presidency, and at the inauguration and thereafter, Bernstein and Felicia were regular attendees at White House functions. So they were very close. And of course, when Kennedy died, Bernstein was stricken terribly.
Barry Seldes is my guest. He's professor of political science at Rider University. His new book is called Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You just heard a bit of Divertimento for Orchestra, recorded in 1980. My guest this hour is Barry Seldes, who's professor of political science at Rider University. We're talking today about the composer of that piece you just heard, Leonard Bernstein. The book is called Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. That piece was 1980, Barry, and you alluded to this earlier, that he always sort of, Bernstein wanted to create this sort of masterwork, the great American opera, and that failed to materialize. Can you talk about how his approach to his work and his enthusiasm for it sort of changed over the years?
Right. The first time we really learn about this desire of his goes back to 1948. Remember that when Roosevelt had died, the New Deal fairly much died with it. Harry Truman was never the New Dealer that Roosevelt was, and certainly with the onset of the blacklist, of the loyalty security hearings, of McCarthyism, and the like, in the post-war era, there was a good deal of gloom in the left, on the left. In 1948, however, Henry Wallace, former New Dealer, great New Dealer, began to run for the presidency against Truman, and then, of course, John Dewey on the Thomas Dewey on the Republican Party ticket. And it looked in February of 48 that Wallace was going to be a winner. And at that moment, Bernstein was conducting a revival of Blitzstein's Cradle Will Rock, clearly a signal of left-wing ambition and aspiration. And he said at that moment, I'm going to write the great American opera. Now, this is a very important moment. He said, I'm able to write this opera, and the opera was going to be, as we can imagine, a clarion call to the progressive electorate. Well, within a very short while, a few months later, it was quite apparent that that electorate had evaporated. And Bernstein, who had also been working on the more somber and sober Age of Anxiety, stuck with that and dropped the opera. But the opera was always in the back of his mind, whether it would be an opera or something more than just an opera, as Mass turned out to be. But it was always on his mind to write this great, great clarion call again to his constituency, to the great American audience. By the 1970s, after the disappointment with the end of the 60s was apparent, Bernstein was in the doldrums, and so were so many others on the left. But in 1976, with the bicentenary celebration, he was commissioned to write a work, and he wrote it a little late, 1977, Songfest, which he subtitled Notes for an American Opera. So this was obviously back in his mind again. And this was the piece that he was going to write. He was hunting for a libretto or some text upon which he could base the work, and continued doing this search, picking up pieces, bits and pieces here and there, working with Jerome Robbins and others on projects that didn't materialize. And as time went on, as he grew ill and was in Prague just a few weeks before he died, he wrote a poem in which he rued the fact that he had never written that great piece. And that was the piece that he, as I say, he died disappointed not having written. It would have been a piece, again, that would have been of tremendous social and political significance.
20 years before he died, there was an incident that a lot of people look at as something he never fully recovered from either, and that was that he attended a Black Panther event where the writer Tom Wolfe was also in attendance. Can you talk about what happened?
Right. What happened there was the Black Panthers had been under indictment in New York City. Many of them kept in solitary confinement. They had their legal defense fund was nil. Felicia Bernstein, Leonard's wife, ran a party to raise funds for the Black Panthers, and it was held in their apartment in Manhattan. A number of we will say socialites, but of course very well-to-do, well-heeled people, Bernstein's friends, and others showed up at this party for the fundraiser, and Bernstein walked in after a performance or after a rehearsal and apparently quickly took charge, got into a kind of mutual respect, mutual admiration discussion with a man named Cox, I think it is, who was the head of the Black Panthers at that party. And, of course, this was then written up as radical chic, in other words, a kind of elegant slumming, as the New York Times entitled it. Bernstein, of course, was outraged. He had had a long history of action, of acts with the civil rights movement and the like, and therefore this was nothing for him terribly out of his past, out of the ordinary. But it was written up as if he had suddenly plunged into this as an amateur. Of course, the what happened next was that the Jewish Defense League, among others, organized assemblies that were going to literally sit in his apartment building, and the FBI, now Hoover, developed a rather malicious counterintelligence program. Did I say 1976? 1970, I'm sorry. Program to do in Bernstein another way. They were going to send letters which were fabricated from Jewish people condemning Bernstein. So this sent him into a terrible, terrible depression. And of course, the New York Times and others only added to that by condemning him for the act of even holding such a party for the Black Panthers.
Did that make him sort of professionally radioactive? I mean, he did continue to work and conduct and appear in places.
Interestingly enough, it didn't. And it was, in fact, right after that, he decided to stare the whole business in the face, so to speak, by holding yet another fundraiser, this time for the Berrigans, the one I mentioned earlier. Hmm. So that came on the heels of the Black Panther meeting.
What sort of speaker was he?
Very eloquent. In fact, what I'm amazed at is not only his eloquence. Of course, he was a television personality. The Thursday night lectures that he gave to the audiences in Carnegie Hall, the omnibus shows, the speeches he made. What I always found extraordinary was in looking at the manuscripts for his speeches, he virtually wrote them out in first drafts in pencil. So he was a very eloquent man and spoke elegantly, so he would have made a wonderful college professor, which he was, by the way, for a couple of years during the blacklist era at Brown.
Well, I have to imagine that he brought that trademark energy that if people have seen recordings of him conducting, they will understand exactly what I'm talking about. Must have come forth when he was speaking as well.
Right. Of course, his flamboyance as conductor was not shown. As a speaker, he was, how shall I say, a good academic. I don't mean by that the sentences were prolonged, but rather he spoke eloquently, but not flamboyantly, whereas on the podium, he was quite flamboyant.
He did have a sense of humor about himself, though.
I beg your pardon?
He did have a sense of humor about himself.
That's an interesting question that I haven't thought about. What he did think about himself was that he had a mission to play. And the mission to play was that as a great educator, he was going to use either the podium or the speech, the writings, whatever it might be, to bring his audiences into a higher area of cultivation. I think that, and political awareness, I think that's what helped Bernstein saw himself.
Barry, when you look back on his life, it's so interesting. He was sort of knocked down so many times for holding the views that he did, and yet he would get back up again and take these, what for the day were considered radical positions. Do you think that he simply was defiant and said, I believe this and I'm going to do it? Or do you think it was almost like a drive within him that he couldn't turn away from even had he chosen to do so?
I think the latter. I think that he learned this as a child at home. The oppression that the Jewish people had lived under for centuries and centuries, and that kind of left liberalism never deserted him. That's why, for example, he showed up in the Montgomery, the march from Selma to Montgomery in 1965, and made a speech welcoming the marchers, and he knew that he could be in the crosshairs of a Klansman's rifle. He did it. That kind of thing. He didn't have to do any of those things. He didn't have to make the speeches against the war. Nothing compelled him to do that, save some inner drive.
You mentioned earlier that you are a great fan of Gustav Mahler, and you have some very interesting stuff in the book, sort of discussing the way Bernstein's interpretation of Mahler's impact seemed to really evolve throughout the course of the 1960s. Will you talk about that a little bit?
Right. He saw in Mahler a predecessor in a number of ways, Mahler being Jewish, Mahler having conducted the New York Philharmonic, Mahler being a composer. But what was more important was he saw in Mahler's music a kind of apocalyptic outlook. Mahler's music is, at times, it can be very lyrical when suddenly broken up with all kinds of extraordinary clashes, cataclysmic moments, which Bernstein saw as kind of heralding the cataclysms which were to occur in Europe. Mahler had died in 1911, had suffered from anti-Semitism in Vienna, and again, Bernstein saw Mahler then as a an exemplar, or rather, yes, an exemplar in composition sense of a man who's going to express the great conflicts that were about to happen, the great cataclysms that were about to cascade through the century. And as the 60s wore on, Bernstein saw this increasingly. In the early 60s, when he was conducting the full cycle of Bernstein, of Mahler symphonies, he saw Mahler more aesthetically, but by the mid-60s, with the war, the civil rights movement, Bernstein began to see in Mahler increasingly this political message coming through. And it was for him, Mahler's music was for him, the way he expressed what he couldn't express in his own music, the piece that he couldn't write. He instead found expression for at the podium conducting Mahler.
That's an extraordinary humility for someone who was also known as a great composer.
Well, yes. I think Mahler was the composer he wanted to be, a man coming out of Middle Europe. Of course, Bernstein couldn't quite do that. But certainly, of the great, great tradition from Haydn on through Beethoven, on through Brahms to Mahler, that great tradition, Bernstein saw himself at the podium as a champion on recordings and, of course, performances. But Mahler's music was for him, and I think it epitomized everything he stood for. Perhaps Shostakovich right behind that. But Mahler certainly, and of course Bernstein was the great champion of Mahler. Mahler's music, he directed the centenary of Mahler's life by conducting, along with others, the symphonies during the 1960s, bringing them to the fore, and by recording the whole cycle of Mahler's music, which had never been done before, Bernstein had made Mahler what he is today. It still packs the concert halls.
Barry, you actually stumbled into a Bernstein rehearsal back when you were in high school. I would love it if you talk about that encounter.
I was in college, yes.
Oh, in college, okay.
I was at City College in New York, and across the street from the building I came out of one summer's day, I was in summer school, was Lewis Stadium, now knocked down, unfortunately, but a great amphitheater within which we had gym classes in the regular semesters in which the Philharmonic performed in the summer. And I walked out of class, and I heard the Philharmonic. I said, wow. I ran across the street and walked right in there, and there was the Philharmonic being conducted by Joseph Cripps, the conductor from Vienna, Bernstein at the piano. His sweating profusely. It was a hot summer's day, and the Philharmonic player said, let's have a lunch break. And Leonard Bernstein said, oh, no, we're going to play on. And Joseph Cripps said, well, Lenny, I like the German accent. He said, well, Lenny, no, I think we should take the lunch break. And Bernstein was very upset. And when some of the my fellow students walked up to him with notebooks and pens and pencils for his autograph, he said, no autographs. He was angry. But I respected him for the drive, for the work ethic. It was marvelous to see him in that sense. I, of course, I saw him in other venues. Never met him, unfortunately. But I got within yards. One of my favorite memories.
Well, and you write that you learned a lot about him through his files, but you were sort of overwhelmed with this desire to have known him personally, to sort of plumb his intellectual depths as a person.
Oh, I would have loved to have known him. I met people who did know him, and almost inevitably, it's his flamboyance on the one hand, but also his tremendous aesthetic sensibility, which was very apparent to everyone who studied with him. I've known people who met him in various guises. Every one of them who met him this way said that they were overwhelmed by his musicality, by his educational outlook. He conducted the Westminster Choir, which is part of my university, and a good colleague of mine with whom I teach every year, Lindsay Christensen, sang with the Westminster Choir back in, I think it's 70, I'm sorry, it's 92, in Mahler's Second Symphony, a photograph of which is in my book. And she remembers him, as do so many others at Westminster, for being such a wonderful, wonderful teacher, which is what he was. He was a teacher. He was a great educator. And that came through in every one of the ways in which he lived his life as conductor, as composer, as lecturer, educator, whatever.
Barry Seldes is professor of political science at Rider University. His new book is called Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Museum. Barry, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
My pleasure, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.